You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Good evening. I'm Judy Ansel. Tonight's show is being underwritten by American Federation of Government Employees, Local 1336, and Blake and Ulig. The American Federation of Government Employees, Local 1336, represents Social Security employees across the states of Kansas and Missouri and in Omaha, Nebraska, Des Moines, Iowa, and Dallas, Texas. Unions ensure a fair and equitable work environment. We are the voice for those who have none, strength in numbers. And since 1972, Blake and Ulig has prided itself on providing comprehensive legal representation to labor organizations and their affiliated benefits funds on a local, regional, and national basis. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, state legislatures, including Iowa and Arkansas, are rolling back child labor laws. Ultra-conservative groups, including the National Restaurant Association, are pushing bills that allow 14-year-olds to work the night shift cleaning meatpacking plants and 15-year-olds to work on assembly lines. We'll ask guests from the Economic Policy Institute and from Texas Immigrant Rights Organization why and what can be done, and ask how weakening child labor laws impacts and exploits some of the most vulnerable children, immigrants. In the news, California taco restaurant sends fake priest to take confession from workers on workplace sins. And new map of derailments shows that Kansas City area is one of the nation's worst hotspots. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg, and we're going to be talking about poverty. Now for the news.
This is the news from our side for June 22, 2023. A California taqueria chain under investigation for wage theft hired a person that identified as a priest to compel employees to confess to their workplace sins. An employee of Taqueria Garibaldi testified during a federal court case brought by the Department of Labor that the Sacramento, California area restaurant chain offered employees the false priest to hear confessions during work hours. In a news release, the DOL stated, "The employee told the court the priest urged workers to get the sins out and urged employees if they had stolen from their employer, been late for work, or had done anything to harm their employer, or if they had bad intentions towards their employer." On May 8th, Taqueria Garibaldi, which owns three restaurants, agreed to a consent judgment ordering the restaurant to pay $140,000 in back wages and damages to 35 employees. The Labor Department investigation found that Taqueria Garibaldi denied employees overtime pay for hours over 40 in a work week, a violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act. The DOL stated, quote, "Federal wage and hour investigators have seen corrupt employers try all kinds of scams to shortchange workers and to intimidate or retaliate against employees, but this attempt to use an alleged priest to get employees to admit to their workplace sins may be among the most shameless," end quote. The DOL also determined that the employer illegally paid managers from the employee tip pool, threatened employees with retaliation and adverse immigration consequences for cooperating with the department, and fired one employee they suspected of complaining to the department, all of which is illegal. Under oath, an employee reported that a manager falsely claimed that immigration issues would be raised by the department's investigation. In addition to aiding the recovery of $70,000 in back wages and an equal amount in liquidated damages, the judge ordered the restaurant and its owners to pay the department $5,000 in penalties, citing the willful nature of their violations. Regional Solicitor of Labor Mark Pilliton said, "The U.S. Department of Labor and its solicitor's office will not tolerate workplace retaliation and will act swiftly to make clear that immigration status has no bearing on workers' rights under the Fair Labor Standards Act."
In a ruling that will make it easier for gig workers to unionize, the National Labor Relations Board has reworked the test for determining whether a worker is an employee and thus covered by the National Labor Relations Act or an independent contractor who would not be covered. In an Atlanta Opera case, the NLRB discarded a Trump board ruling that used entrepreneurial opportunity as the key factor in determining employee versus independent contractor status. The new test, which reinstates a prior Obama ruling, will evaluate common law factors, control over the worker, skill level, and how the worker is paid, without giving enhanced weight to any particular factor. The board's ruling paves the way for workers in a gig economy, such as Uber or Lyft drivers, to be classified as employees and get coverage under the NLRA. As the board's majority put it in their opinion, applying this clear standard will ensure that workers who seek to organize or exercise their rights under the National Labor Relations Act are not improperly excluded from its protections.
The Mother Jones Statue campaign announced on June 19th that it has received $250,000 funding for a statue of the famed labor organizer and hellraiser to be erected at the Water Tower on Chicago's Magnificent Mile. The campaign has worked for years on this project. This project is part of a package in support of multiple projects of underrepresented people's projects. The Mellon Foundation announced a grant of $6.8 million to the City of Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events to support the Chicago Monuments Project and citywide community-generated commemorative initiatives and installations. The projects for new Chicago monuments will also include the Chicago Torture Justice Memorial. These projects will add, permanently and temporarily, to the City of Chicago's collection and memorialize events, people, and groups that historically have been excluded or underrepresented.
Railway Workers United e-newsletter reports that the National League of Cities has launched an interactive heat map showing the frequency of train derailments across the country. The map allows users to see an overview of derailments and dive deeper into details on specific incidents. Clarence E. Anthony, CEO and Executive Director of the National League of Cities, commented, "With rail tracks running through the middle of thousands of cities, towns, and villages, derailments are a big concern for residents who want to keep their families and businesses safe." The website states every day in the United States, an average of 3 trains derail, with as many as half potentially carrying hazardous substances. With 140,000 miles of track in the United States crossing through thousands of cities, towns, and villages, rail safety is a concern for residents in communities of all sizes. Unfortunately, train derailments like the one in East Palestine, Ohio, in February 2023 are not isolated incidents, with over 1,000 happening each year in the United States. The interactive map displays railroad derailments between 2012 and 2023 as compiled by the U.S. Department of Transportation's Federal Rail Administration. The map accounts for all railway networks in the United States and the congressional districts where derailments occurred. Just one glance at it shows that Kansas City and its region as the hottest in the nation, meaning we have had more derailments and higher costs because of them than anywhere else. By clicking on the map, the various red dots, you can get the specifics on each derailment and its cost. To see the map, go to nlc.org and search for derailment map. The news from our side was read by Ariana Blockman, Tom Gebkin, Christina Desmang, and I'm Stephen Hill.
I used to be a factory hand. Things were moving slow. When children worked in cotton mills, each morning had to go. Every morning, just at 5, the whistle blew on time and called them babies out of bed at the age of 8 and 9. Come out of bed, little sleepy heads, and get your bite to eat. The factory whistle's calling you, there's no more time to sleep. Children all grew up on land. They never went to school. They never learned to read and write, but learned to spin and spool. Every time I close my eyes, I see that picture still. When textile work was carried on with babies in the mill.
That was Dorsey Dixon with Babies in the Mill. I'm Mark Galis. The focus of tonight's show is the issue of child labor. We'll first look at it from legal and policy perspectives. In 1916, Congress passed the Keating-Owen Child Labor Act, which sought to reduce child labor by prohibiting the interstate sale of goods produced by factories that employed children under the age of 14, mines that employed children younger than 16, and any facility where children under 14 worked after 7 p.m. or before 6 a.m., or more than 8 hours a day. In 1918, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Hammer v. Dagenhart, struck down the law, holding that the Commerce Clause did not permit Congress to regulate working conditions. In dissent, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes famously wrote, quote, "But if there is any matter upon which civilized countries have agreed, it is the evil of premature and excessive child labor," end quote. After a legal challenge to the Fair Labor Standards Act that was passed in 1938, during the height of the New Deal, the Supreme Court overruled the Hammer case, holding in U.S. v. Darby Lumber in 1941 that Congress did indeed have the power to regulate working conditions under the Commerce Clause. Since that time, child labor protections have been adopted by both federal and state governments. Minimum age standards, limits on employment in hazardous occupations, maximum hours of work, and times of day a child may work. But in the past few years, state governments have started rolling back certain child labor protections. But why? Joining us is Nina Mast, State Economic Analyst for EARN, the Economic Analysis and Research Network, at EPI, the Economic Policy Institute. Nina, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with definitions. What do we mean by child labor? I assume we're not talking about the neighbor kid who mows lawns in the summer.
Right. So when we're talking about child labor, we're really honed in specifically on excessive or dangerous work done by children and youth. So working longer hours in hazardous occupations, that's really the thrust of what we're focusing on. Although I do think it's important to stress that any job can be a dangerous job for youth. And that's why we have these guardrails in place to really protect youth and make sure that they are involved in safe and age-appropriate work.
So how is child labor regulated with respect to federal and state law?
So it's regulated at both the state and federal laws, particularly through the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is sort of a landmark piece of labor legislation passed during the New Deal era. And this really governs a lot of our labor standards, whether that's the minimum wage or overtime protections, but it also governs child labor provisions, particularly around the hours that youth can work, as well as which occupations they can work in and what types of work they can do. And then the Department of Labor, the U.S. Department of Labor at the federal level, enforces and investigates potential violations of child labor laws, and they work with state labor departments and agencies to sort of co-lead those investigations and discover potential violations of the law.
And I would assume that states have their own set of rules and regulations and laws that deal with child labor at a state level.
That's right. And to the extent that an employer is regulated by the Fair Labor Standards Act, and that's most employers, they are subject to federal laws as well. So states can go above the minimum standards required by the FLSA, but they can't go below them.
Are there particular industries that rely on child labor? I know most people have seen pictures from the early 1900s of the 12-year-olds in the coal mines in West Virginia with soot on all over their faces. What kind of industries rely on child labor?
So there's really many different industries that rely on child labor. Although the violations that we are seeing increasingly in the past couple of years have been a lot of fast food restaurants where youth are employed for longer hours or are not paid overtime or are expected to use hazardous equipment like deep fat fryers or other sharp tools that are prohibited for youth to be able to use. We also see a lot of child labor used in meat packing. For example, the Packer sanitation case that was widely covered in the media involved young people as young as 10 years old cleaning equipment on the slaughterhouse floor and meat packing plants and other sort of factory environments. We also see child labor in construction, like roofing, demolition. There's been multiple cases of falls and other injuries and even fatalities in the past few years on construction sites in which children were not supposed to be working.
Two questions from that. One, dealing with violations, is it correct that child labor violations have gone up significantly in the last few years?
That's right. Yeah, we've seen a significant increase in the violations of the Department of Labor's hazardous occupations orders or other rules governing child labor in the past few years. So we calculated a 283% increase in child labor violations over fiscal year 2015. Over the past, 7 years, there's been almost a 300% increase in the number of violations found by the Department of Labor. And there's also been an increase in violations of the hazardous occupations orders, which governs the types of work that children can do.
Does child labor affect migrant children disproportionately compared to children who are citizens who live in the United States already?
It's difficult to know because when the Department of Labor collects information about violations of child labor laws, they don't collect or report immigration status as part of that enforcement. But we do believe that unaccompanied migrant children are forced into this type of work at high rates because they are facing economic desperation. They maybe have to repay debts as a consequence of coming to the country. They have no money and are unable to support themselves and are basically on their own in many cases. So we really do think that this is an issue that affects low-income Black and brown youth and immigrants at higher rates than the typical young person, or at least they are particularly harmed from the exploitative nature of some of these jobs.
The past couple of years, there have been a number of headlines about states seeking to roll back child labor protections. One of the reactions to that I've seen among people that I've talked to about this is, why? Like, what on earth is going on? Who could ever think that was a good idea? And so I will ask you, what on earth is going on?
Yeah, it is an interesting question, and it's a difficult one to answer. I mean, so what we're seeing is in the past 2 years, at least 14 states have introduced or passed laws rolling back child labor. And if you only look at the past year, the 2022-2023 legislative session, 11 states have introduced bills. So it's really something that's ramping up. And as you know, two states have already passed laws this year that roll back protections for child labor, Iowa and Arkansas. A main reason we're seeing for these bills being introduced is the tight labor market we're seeing, in which, workers for the first time in many years have really had a slight ability to advocate or demand higher wages in the labor market. But instead of paying them the wages that are demanded by a competitive labor market, employers would rather replace them with child workers who can be paid less and changing the laws so that they can treat those children more like adults. I would say, while in the past you'd see attempts in one or two states, we're really seeing a more coordinated, multi-industry effort to get these laws passed, particularly with the help of groups like the Foundation for Government Accountability and other sort of right-wing think tanks and lobbying organizations who are allied with industry groups like the Retailer Association, Hotel and Lodging Associations, the National Restaurant Association, the building and construction industry, and other industries that benefit from child labor.
So that was one of my questions in terms of who's behind this. It's unlikely that a legislator from a Midwestern state that might not be thinking about this would come up with this on their own. So with everything else in politics, I imagine there was some lobbying behind it. You indicated some lobbying in industry groups. Is it also the case that most of this is happening in a certain region of the country, or is it happening in states in which the Republican Party controls either the governor's mansion or the legislature?
We're definitely seeing the most activity in states where there's complete Republican control. That's the case in Iowa and Arkansas. And then in terms of regions, a lot of these bills are in the Midwest and in the South, though we have seen a few bills in the Northeast, like in Maine and New Hampshire. New Jersey passed a law a couple of years ago rolling back child labor protection. So it's not isolated to only one region or political environment. We've seen bills in Minnesota where there's a Democratic trifecta, but I think those bills were in states where there's more Democratic control have made less progress through the legislature. So these states, these industry groups and their partners in government are really taking advantage of complete Republican control in certain states and using that to pass what would otherwise be pretty unpopular bills.
You mentioned that Iowa and Arkansas have already enacted legislation to roll back child labor protections. Can you give us some idea of what kind of provisions are in those new rollbacks?
Sure. So in Arkansas, the primary focus of the bill was to remove the paper trail that requires young people to get permission from their parents and then from the Division of Labor in order to be employed. This was a one-page form that parents had to sign that included information about a child's rights in the workplace and that allowed enforcement agencies to be able to track and have a record of this employment relationship for the future in case of any potential issues. That requirement was removed, and the governor stated that this was sort of an arbitrary burden and that removing the requirement, quote, restored decision-making to parents. Although I think it's debatable how much you're restoring decision-making to parents when you're removing the requirement that informed of their rights and about their child's employment. In Iowa, the law that was passed was particularly egregious, although I would say it was much worse before labor and policymakers really pushed to remove some of the most egregious parts of the legislation. But this is still a pretty expansive bill that creates a lot of changes in the law. So it allows employers to hire teens as young as 14 for previously prohibited jobs in industrial laundries, as well as children as young as 15 in light assembly work. It also allows the state agencies to waive restrictions on some hazardous work. It extends hours to allow teens to work longer shifts. It allows restaurants to have teens as young as 16 serve alcohol, and it limits states' ability to impose penalties on employers that break the law.
We talked earlier about the federal and state schemes in terms of regulation. So is there any discussion about these state laws now running afoul of the floor put in place by the Fair Labor Standards Act?
There is. And the
Solicitor of Labor?
Solicitor of Labor, Seema Nanda, actually sent a letter to lawmakers in Iowa informing them that multiple provisions of the law they just passed likely conflict with federal standards, saying that the federal standards with respect to child labor cannot be nullified by state law. So essentially, the Department of the U.S. Department of Labor is aware that that new Iowa law conflicts with federal law. And I think there's conversations happening about what to do about this and how to enforce the law, given that Iowa has basically said, we won't do it ourselves. It's difficult for the federal government to be able to handle so many cases and, you know, have to be so involved in every state's affairs, which may become the case as more states attempt to roll back these protections.
So you're left with possible litigation by the government, the problem being not enough resources to go after. It's one thing to go after Iowa, but if it's Iowa and Arkansas and Minnesota and all these other states, it makes it more difficult in an understaffed climate, right?
That's right. And the Department of Labor already has their own investigations, over 600 that they're currently involved in. So this really adds more to their plate and an environment which they just simply can't handle all of these labor standards issues. And all of the resources it puts into investigating child labor are resources that can't be spent on the myriad other labor standards issues that the Department of Labor handles.
They have a lot to do other than this.
That's right.
Well, this is problematic and troubling in any number of ways, as we've kind of mentioned. So you've done a lot of good reporting on this through EPI. What can be done from a policy perspective or otherwise? What can be done to stem the tide here and to fight back against these child labor rollbacks?
Yeah, so there are multiple bills at the federal level that policymakers can support, including the PRO Act, Protect the Right to Organize Act, which really just strengthens workers' rights and their ability to organize in their workplace. There's also the CARE Act, which has been reintroduced once again, that would raise the age for farm workers. There are many things we can do to reform the two-tiered system of labor standards enforcement in agriculture and non-agricultural employment. Agriculture has very weak protections compared to other industries. And so that's one place we suggest starting is by reforming the system of agriculture that allows youth at very young ages to work long hours in very hazardous occupations. We also would like to see sub-minimum wages for youth eliminated. Many states and the federal government allow young people to be paid lower wages, either permanently or temporarily, if they're a certain age. And we've seen bills even this year to introduce new sub-minimum wages for youth. So we'd like to see those eliminated and to have all workers paid at least the minimum wage. We want workers to be paid a higher minimum wage to raise the floor for all workers, because child labor does not only harm children, it lowers standards for all workers. So it harms adult workers as well. We'd like to see stronger wage theft enforcement and stronger enforcement of all the laws that protect workers, particularly child workers in this case. And that comes through increased funding to the Department of Labor for enforcement and investigation of these and violations, as well as enforcement of all the wage payment laws that we see violated, whether that's overtime protections, the failure to pay the minimum wage, or any other standards. And then we'd like to see states do more to empower young workers in their states, whether that's through just worker organizing, making it easier for workers to form unions, and really just supporting young people as they embark on their first job in this economy and trying to make sure that job is a safe and age-appropriate job.
Is there anything that our listeners could do to help with this?
Yeah, I mean, your listeners can support campaigns to raise the minimum wage or eliminate sub-minimum wages in their state. Really, any campaign to improve worker standards is always welcome. Listeners can reach out to their federal legislator and demand their support to the PRO Act and other federal legislation that protects and expands the rights of workers, and really just educate and inform their own networks about these issues, about the need for strong labor standards to protect workers of all ages.
In the time we have left, could you tell us a little bit about EPI and the work you do there?
Sure. So the Economic Policy Institute is a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank created in 1986 to include the needs of low and middle income workers in economic policy discussions. So EPI conducts research and analysis on the economic status of working people and then proposes policies to expand and protect the rights of workers. The EARN team is a state-based network within EPI, and we convene, we have partners in 43 states, and we sort of convene and provide assistance to different groups that are working on economic policy advocacy in their states.
Well, this has been a very interesting discussion, and I appreciate you coming on with us. Nina Mast, State Economic Analyst for EARN, the Economic Analysis and Research Network at EPI, the Economic Policy Institute. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
KKFI is hiring. We are now accepting applications for a bookkeeper, office administrator position at KKFI's offices at 39th and Main in Midtown, Kansas City. This is a full-time, 32 hours per week position that is responsible for supporting the administrative and financial needs of our growing organization. For more details, including required skills and how to apply, please go online to kkfi.org/jobs.
July 10 is the deadline for Jackson County homeowners to appeal reassessments. Some homeowners have seen their assessments double, reportedly forcing some to sell. Jackson County has an automated online appeal filing system. If you cannot find that, email boardofequalization@jacksongov.org or call 816-881-3309. This message is a public service of KKFI.
Good evening. Welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm your host, Christina Disming. For our second half of our show, we will be continuing the discussion on the impact that these bills with child labor will have on one of our most vulnerable populations, migrant children. With me is Legal Director Imelda Mayard at the from the Diocesan Migrant and Refugee Services. Imelda, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
All right, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. Well, first of all, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do at DRMS in El Paso?
Sure. So DMRS is the largest legal service provider here in West Texas and New Mexico. So we provide immigrant legal services for recent arrivals, as well as people that have been in the community for a while who want to go from being permanent residents to citizens, as well as everywhere in between. I began with the organization as one of the supervising attorneys for the Unaccompanied Minors Unit, and now I am the legal director.
Well, that's great that we have you on the show with us, because I think you'll definitely add a perspective that we need here, and definitely one that I think more people need to know about. And before we start discussing the specific bills and this push to basically roll back child labor, could you discuss or talk a little bit about the unique challenges that already face a lot of our migrant children when they enter here in the United States?
Sure. So when migrant children enter the United States, I mean, they essentially face the same hurdles and obstacles that adults do, in that, you know, they're coming to a new country where they may not be familiar with the customs, the language. Things get much more difficult when we're talking about unaccompanied children. So those are children that enter the United States without actual an adult to supervise them. So they're essentially alone. So the way it works is, if a child comes to the border and they're accompanied by anyone other than their biological parents, the child will be separated from whichever adult they happen to cross with, whether that's a grandparent or an adult sibling. And that's mostly for the safety of the child. The goal is once the child is separated from their family member, if they happen to have traveled with one, many do not. I mean, many children appear at the border alone. Then they're sent to a refugee shelter run by the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And the goal is to try and reunite them with family that they may have here in the United States. The children in the shelters, if they have family members, their challenges are really just they're in an unfamiliar place, depending on how old they might be. It may be very jarring just to be in a place with a ton of other children that you don't know, with adults you don't know. It's a 24-hour facility, and they're just waiting to be reunited. For the children that don't have anybody, I think the journey is much more harrowing. Because they just don't know what to expect. And so they're very disoriented. And that's sort of where our organization comes in to try and help the children navigate the immigration process, as well as their new life here in the United States.
And that's one of the things that it's when you're coming alone by yourself is that it's easier to fall between the cracks. It's easier to kind of get lost and to be exploited. And that's one of the issues that keeps on being pop up. I mean, children being exploited has been an issue for a very, very long time. It's nothing new, but the first half of our show, we discussed and brought up some bills that were being brought forward and legislation that was slowly chipping away at the protections that would help these children. And these bills that impact the poorest and most marginalized children, from our Black and brown children to students, children that are poor. But could you discuss and touch on the impact these bills will specifically have on immigrant children, or specifically unaccompanied minors?
I'll be honest, I'm not sure what bills, but to the extent that they strip any sort of protection from children, it can be devastating, right? One of the ways we're able to help unaccompanied minors is usually through obtaining what is known as a special migrant juvenile visa. And those visas are specifically for children whom a state court has found have been abandoned, abused, or neglected by one or both of their parents. And so I think I've seen some versions of bills that have tried to do away with those types of visas, and it would be like incredibly devastating just because, right, those are the most vulnerable of vulnerable children, right? Take away their immigration status or whatever, if you had a neglected child, U.S. citizen child, right, the state is meant to protect them. And so to the extent that we're trying to do anything to curtail or strip protections from children, it's just sort of, it's a horrible thing. It would leave children that are vulnerable in their home country subject to being returned to dangerous situations.
I know specifically with the bills, well, for myself, formerly I was a middle school teacher, and I had a lot of students who, at the end of the school year, especially I had students who were either children of migrants or immigrated themselves to the United States, and a lot of times I will see at the very end of the school year that they will miss the last few weeks of school because they're going somewhere else to either work in a field where their parents were or to go work themselves. And a lot of these bills start opening up suggestions such as increasing how many hours a minor is able to work, or where they're able to work, or the age requirements, or how much they get paid. It's one of those, not every single bill is the same, but there's been so many out there that have started, what I said earlier, like kind of chipping away at this. And one thing I kind of want to look at is, how has the already like broken immigration system that we have, especially when it comes to asylum, how does it add to this exploitation of unaccompanied minors or migrant children that come across to the U.S.?
Right. I mean, to the extent that, you know, the law is looking to increase like the amount of time children can spend working, it's super detrimental because like a lot of the children we encounter that's precisely what they were fleeing, you know, in their home country. They were, you know, at 10, 11 years old, breadwinners, right? Working from like 8 in the morning until 6 p.m. or sometimes as early as 6 in the morning until like 3 p.m. in like, you know, blistering conditions, and then not having time to go to school. So, right, so missing out on an education, missing out on their life, being, you know, exposed to very like dangerous conditions, especially when we're talking about agricultural work, right? Working in the field with, you know, at 10 years old with like machetes or with like poisonous like chemicals and very little things. So it's detrimental when you try to limit labor protections for children, and then you couple that with their asylum status, right? With like trying to get protection in the United States, making it harder to get protection where you absolutely need an attorney, but finding, you know, nonprofit attorneys like us can be very difficult because we run into capacity issues. We can't represent everyone. So then your only choice to try and actually regularize your status is you need a private attorney. Well, private attorneys don't work for free. And so how do you pay for them? Well, you have to work. And then if there are no laws like protecting you to work, you know, as a child, I mean, you're ripe for exploitation. You know, you end up in the same situation that you're fleeing from.
I feel like I've seen that a lot specifically with my students, where there's kind of that in between where they're a little bit too young to work, but they have to because they have to make ends meet. And sometimes they come over with their families, but their families as well, they're in a situation where they need to support themselves. It's not, I've heard from multiple people that a lot of times, wherever it's an unaccompanied minor, they say, where's the parents? Why did they allow this? Or even whenever it's accompanied and the child's working in the factory, it's like, where's the parent in this situation? Why does all this happen? But you've probably seen this multiple times, that people are in these desperate situations where they need to work, and they're not really going to take any job they can to basically make ends meet. And that easily, whether it's the family or when it comes to the child, is allows them to be easily exploited.
Yes, correct. Yeah, I mean, people are in survival mode, and when you're in survival mode, I mean, it's always ripe for exploitation because you're doing what you can to survive, right? It's not even live, it's just to survive and to see tomorrow.
And you mentioned earlier that, I mean, a lot of times it's all about money. It's like finding these private attorneys, it'll make your case a little bit, not necessarily easier, but whenever you have the money, you can finally get status. And people like you that do it pro bono, low bono work. And I know it's, especially when it comes to like this type of legislation, it'll put a more burden on advocates such as yourself. And it seems like at this moment, this is a quite depressing topic for people. And it's kind of like, what is there to do? Is there any like positivity that you could shine on this of work that people are doing with your group or other groups that you've seen that actually help and truly assist with unaccompanied minors or when it comes to child labor with immigrant children?
I mean, sure, there's a ton of nonprofits, you know, not just us, but there's nonprofit organizations around the country that are specifically funded to assist unaccompanied children that enter the United States. And our jobs are not only to, you know, guide them through the immigration system, but also, right, to advocate for their rights. And to the extent that we see any sort of like large scale exploitation or even in individual cases, you know, we explore any and all forms of relief, right? Because it's a fine line between exploitation of a child and labor trafficking. And so if we find that, you know, our client's actually being, there's a labor trafficking situation, so our client's being forced or coerced to work, that opens a new avenue for them to be able to regularize their status in the United States. So we're constantly on the lookout for those situations as well, and as well as other organizations nationwide. But there could always be more. I mean, unfortunately, the need far outsteps the capacity that it currently exists.
No, absolutely. And I think it's this, there's an absolute need, and there's so many people that are doing like what you do, and it feels like at overcapacity, but trying your hardest to make ends meet. And there's so much more of a need out there than people are able to reach. Unfortunately, there's a huge backlog in the system. I mean, all throughout the United States, I know definitely down there in El Paso, but I feel like you see it throughout all reaches in, here in the U.S. If there's anything, we have a couple minutes left. Is there anything that you would like our listeners to know or to understand that they may not necessarily hear that often when it comes to either unaccompanied minors or when it comes to child labor that you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important for people to always remember that when we're talking about, you know, migration, we're talking about human beings and people. And then more so when we're talking about child migration, there's so many reasons why children come to the United States or are sent to the United States. A lot of it is born out of need. A lot of it is fear. I mean, they're fleeing like persecution in their home countries. And so it's really, you know, important to like watch out for children in your communities, right? Because unfortunately, a lot of children do arrive in the United States and they're subject to further exploitation, even sometimes from their own family members, because it's extended family who's receiving them. And a lot of times there's no resources for that family member. You know, once the child leaves government custody, they're on their own. And, you know, the legal services only provide so much. Like, we only cover El Paso County, but like for the children that are in more rural, remote areas of West Texas where there is no like legal service provider, like that requires community to really come in. And it really, not to be cliche, but it takes a village. To watch out and really watch out for these kids and sort of any weird, you know, things you might see. I think there was an article a couple of months ago that was released that talked about like this like large scale exploitation of children. I think it was at meat processing plants, and it came to light because teachers were noticing like their students were like falling asleep early, and like when, you know, in class, and when they actually like took the time to ask, you know, they uncovered like there was this like large scale exploitation of kids working that weren't supposed to be. So as a community, you know, just be vigilant and watch out for, you know, the least among us.
It's definitely the saying, see something, say something. I mean,
exactly.
As a teacher, we're mandated reporters, but even when, if you're not a teacher, if you're noticing something within, exactly, it's not cliche. It does take a village to raise a child or those within your community. So,
right.
And we're getting to about the last minute of our show, but if our listeners are interested in learning more about this topic or find more about the work that you do down in El Paso, where can they go to?
Sure, they can come to our website. We are at www.dmrs-ep.org. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook and all of the social medias at our handle, dmrs-ep.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
And everyone, that was Imelda Maynard finishing up on our conversation about the concerning issues around child labor, especially with unaccompanied minors. And make sure you stay tuned for the Thursday night special. I'm your host, Christine Disming, and you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel, and it's time for Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg, who is on the phone with us from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you very much, Judy.
You wanted to talk about poverty, and you start your article in your news by quoting Reverend William Barber saying, "Poverty equals death. The Poor People's mm-hmm. Campaign is renewing its drive to put poverty eradication on top of the U.S. agenda." And they had a Poverty Action Congress this week and lobbying of elected officials. You quote Barber as saying, Poverty is the fourth leading cause of death nationwide, and poverty is bad for all of us. Can you unpack that for us?
Sure. The fourth leading cause of death was based on a study done by one of the panelists, a professor named David Brady. He's a sociologist at UC Santa Barbara, I believe. I wanted the story right in front of me. And once he picked out, even using the federal poverty line, which is absurdly low,
right,
he found that the deaths from poverty factors, and that includes starvation, that includes bad health, that includes inaccess to health care, bad housing, homelessness, and a whole bunch of other things that lead to systemic poverty, wind up producing something like fourth leading cause of death in the country, in so many words. Huh. The only things ahead of it are things like are shootings and auto accidents.
Okay. And when he says that poverty is bad for all of us, what do you think he meant?
Mm-hmm. Well, he pointed out that if you empower people, if you give them a decent job and a decent place to live and a decent living wage, you pump in $330 billion into the economy, and that, to use John F. Kennedy's old phrase, though he didn't use it, the rising tide lifts all boats, not just the poor, but everybody else.
So actually, eradicating poverty would be good for all of us. That's what it sounds
exactly.
like you're saying.
He said, don't ask what the cost of eradicating poverty is. Ask what the cost of not eradicating poverty is.
So what does the Poor People's Campaign say are the root causes of poverty?
Well, structural racism is one, but a big one is public policy. Things like the minimum wage hasn't been raised since 2009.
Yeah.
Things like weak labor laws, which take effect or affect workers' right to organize and workers' right to protect themselves in Kansas and Missouri. Things like the TANF program, which is the old welfare support program, throws people off after only a few weeks, and they can't come back. Things like aid for basic services is very limited, and is always cut. It's always the first thing that gets cut when somebody needs to cut the budget.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know. I think a lot of Democrats like to blame the Republicans for the persistence of poverty, but from your article, I think that the Democrats are as guilty as the Republicans for not eradicating it. Is that right?
That's what Reverend Barber said. Don't count on, he said in so many words, you can't count on either the Democrats or the Republicans. The Democrats became enthralled to neoliberalism, quote unquote, and neoliberal economic policies, and ignore the poor. I mean, still to some extent do. You got in their lobbying yesterday, they got a lot of attention in Congress, but they've been knocking on the door of the White House for a couple of years now. They've met with White House aides. They haven't met with Biden. And he wouldn't, it's not just Barber and Theo Harris. He'd take actual poor people in with him.
It sounds like the the main problem they face, or we all face, is that neither party wants to put eradicating poverty at the top of their agenda. So
exactly.
So what's Barber's and the Poor People's Campaign's strategy to do that?
Mobilize, educate, and register people to vote and get them out there to vote.
Well, haven't they been trying to do that for a long time?
Yeah, they actually succeeded to a good extent in both 2020 and 2022. They took credit for mobilizing enough poor people to swing states for Biden in 2020 and to hold the losses down in 2022.
Did Biden say thank you?
No, not yet.
Okay. Well, we'll keep posted on this, and it'll be interesting to see if they can make any headway this year and next year. Thanks so much, Mark. We've been talking to Mark Grinberg with Washington Window on Workers. I'm Judy Ansel.
Okay, thank you.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar, which is very short. It seems like everybody's doing fun summer stuff and they're not doing social justice kind of stuff so much. But if any of you out there knew Brian Elam, there's going to be a memorial gathering for him. Brian was a rank and file union superstar, and we will miss him sorely. This is going to be Sunday, June 25th at 6 p.m. at the American Legion Hall in Argentine, Kansas, in Kansas City, Kansas, at 1044 South 26th Street, KCK. This is near the entrance to the KCK BNSF rail yard where Brian worked. TDU, the Teamsters for a Democratic Union, is having an online briefing. It's titled Make UPS Deliver for the Working Class. It'll be next Wednesday, June 28th, 7 p.m. Central Time. This is online. You can register at tdu.org/June28. And labor notes. It announced its Secrets of a Successful Organizer trainings for July. They will be July 12th, 19th, and 26th from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time. This is online, and you can register at labornotes.org/events. If you missed any of that, you can find our calendar on the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page, where we invite you to subscribe and like our postings. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. We're going to be interviewing Ahmed White about his new book, Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers. And the second part of the show will be asking the question, isn't it time to nationalize the railroads? The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. There's also a weekly Labor Radio Network compendium of shows from around the country, which is really interesting to listen to as well. And you can find it at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Stephen Hill. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's a replay of this morning's Cowtown Conversations. And if you live or rent in Jackson County, it's got great information on your property tax assessments and how to protest them.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss. And you can talk back to us, too. Send us your feedback, your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming ones, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on this show are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening at 6 or to our rebroadcast Friday mornings at 5 right here, 90.1 FM, KKFI. We still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be. With all their power and wealth and the material.
they're coming.